Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. Coming up next, we're going to hear about a scam that involved bilking Americans out of $100 million, a scam that was operated out of Tampa's Ybor City. And later on the program, we'll open up the phone lines. But first, one listener comment about yesterday's program. One of the topics brought up yesterday was the Bruce Springsteen ad, the one narrated by Bruce for 2 minutes during the Super Bowl, about bringing the country together. After we discussed it yesterday, here's what one listener had to say.
This is Martin from Palm Harbor. I'm glad for all the sports fans that the Bucks won. Meanwhile, many thousands of us are still unable to get the vaccine. There are over 200,000 seniors in Pinellas County alone, not counting snowbirds. We spend hours online to no avail. Our state government is failing us in a big way. Who do we turn to?
Well, there was a listener comment that came in after yesterday's program. We'll open up the phone lines later on. 10 years ago, veteran investigative reporter Jeff Testerman uncovered a phony charity based in Tampa's Ybor City. It was a charity that raked in tens of millions of dollars every year. It preyed on Americans' concern over protecting and honoring veterans in the wake of 9/11. The charity, called the U.S. Navy Veterans Association, operated in most states and successfully eluded deep scrutiny or sanctions by the government. How did the scam operate and what led to its downfall is the subject of Testerman's new book called Call Me Commander, which Testerman co-wrote with Daniel Freed, a senior producer at CNBC. Testerman uncovered the fraudulent charity when he was a reporter for the then St. Petersburg Times. I spoke with him earlier today.
This is Martin from Palm Harbor.
Jeff Testerman, welcome to WMNF. Thank you for coming on the program.
It's great to be with you, Rob. Thanks for the invitation.
Let me start by saying, in your book, you outlined this amazing scam. And when you run into it, you find the beginning thread of it in Ybor City. Tell us about running across Commander Bobby Thompson in Ybor City. What were you looking for? Did you know that this $100 million scam was going on?
Well, I had no idea. And in the reportorial world that I lived in, you collect paper, you build a file, you follow your story, you trust your records, and you go where your records point you, and you try to connect the dots. And at that point, I was trying to connect the dots and build a file on a person that many in Tampa will remember as Kevin White, the former city councilman and county commissioner. And I was looking into his supposed long and distinguished Navy career that he bragged about, and I'd gotten a hold of his discharge papers that showed White had been in the Navy for 5 weeks at age 17 and then been, for some reason, mustered out. And told people on the political grandstand that, I served a long and distinguished tenure in the U.S. Navy. And I thought, he's exaggerated this story and maybe lied about it. And, that's a story. I think I'm going to write a political story about that when I discovered it. And I ran across in my research and building my file a campaign check to White from a group I'd never heard of called the U.S. Navy Veterans Association. And I said, I'll bet you I'll go see them and tell them about his phony Navy career, and they'll give me a nice quote, and they'll probably welcome me and thank me for coming out. And I called Washington, D.C., where the group was said to be headquartered. You look them up on the net and find a pretty impressive and lengthy website. And they said, we have a spokesman, a director of development right there in Tampa where you are. And I said, that's unbelievable. I'm going to go out. I'm going to get in the car and go out and see him, get a quote, and be on my way and finish my story on Kevin White. So it was very, very much happenstance that I ended up at a dilapidated duplex in a seedy part of Ybor City back in August of 2009, when I drove up to see for the first time Commander Bobby Thompson, as he was known. And I got out of the car. Thompson was actually outside, and he was on the telephone. He had a cell phone in his ear, and he was telling somebody to just send the check to the Navy veterans, care of Commander Thompson. And I walked up on the sidewalk. I introduced myself, and the commander immediately became hostile toward me, which I could not explain why that was. We'd never met. I later learned that he was a rabid reader of the newspaper. He knew who I was. He knew the kind of work I did, which was investigative reporting. And he knew, as I did not know, that he had a number of secrets that he didn't want anyone to know about when I got there. And so he was actually, I would say, combative with me. And this was not the reaction I expected. And I was there for about 20 minutes. He virtually threw me off his property. And I came back to the office, and I sat down with my research partner, John Martin. And he said he'd known I was going out to see this guy. And he said, how'd that go? And I said, well, it didn't go like I thought it was going to go. And I said, I have a hunch about this. I have kind of a feeling that the place I was at didn't look like the home of a retired U.S. Navy commander. And he didn't sound like one, and he didn't act like one. And I wonder what's up. And John immediately said, well, let's look into this. And we began to essentially investigate the U.S. Navy veterans at that point. And the first thing we did is we called up the website, and we began to try to find the officers and directors of the group. This is a supposedly 66,000-member group, bringing in upwards of $5 to $10 million a year by the use of telemarketing companies. They, right there on the page one, they've got their directors. Their CEO is Jack Nimitz, Captain Jack Nimitz, famous Navy name, if you remember, to Chester Nimitz back in World War II. And, you know, John began to pour over the records and the databases that he had access to, and he couldn't find anybody.
Meaning that this Nimitz guy did not exist? Who was?
Well, that's exactly right. You know, we believe, we hold to the notion that real people leave a real documentary footprint with the records that are available to you at the courthouse or elsewhere. And this might be a deed, a mortgage, a divorce. It might even be a letter to the editor. It would be something that indicates, you know, you can be found and you can be tracked, and you, there's a record of you somewhere. And John's quote to me, John Martin said to me, you know, the CEO of a nationwide charity like this does not live off the grid. That's just, that's not how that thing works. And that was his hunch and his instinct. And, of course, I agree with that. And, there was no Nimitz. There was a picture of someone in a blazer and a striped tie, you know, kind of looked like an undertaker, to tell you the truth. And we, but that began the investigation. And we, as I say in the book, the more we looked for evidence of this group, the less we found. And I guess, Rob, one of the key moments was when I called a colleague up in Washington, D.C. Bureau, and I said, would you mind running down to the U.S. Navy Veterans Executive Suites on M Street, pretty good address, near DuPont Circle, maybe a 15, 20-minute walk to the Capitol. So it's a pretty decent address in Washington, D.C. And I said, would you mind going there and knock on the door and rouse somebody at the Navy Veterans and see what's going on? And he sent me a picture about an hour later, and he said the picture was of a mailbox. And the U.S. Navy Veterans address was advertised in an executive suite. It was nothing but a rented mailbox in a strip center.
Mm.
Then we were pretty sure we were on to something.
Yeah. So the U.S. Navy Veterans Association claims 67,000 members. It was operating in most states around the country, it claimed, and it took in tens of millions of dollars a year from people that were donating to this charity. On paper, did everything look pretty good? I mean, if you were to go to the website or if you were to look at the list of names associated, did it look legit?
Well, this was really the brilliance of the con. It did look legit. If you went to the website, which we excavated for months, literally months, ran 2,500 pages. It had financial statements. It had state chapters, officers of the state chapters. It had, the list of the good works that they were doing. It directed you at some point to the 990 tax returns that nonprofits are required to report. It went on and on and on. If you went to the state regulators in the 41 states that they operated, they'd filed their paperwork. They had done what was necessary to receive permission from every state to solicit in that state. And it looked absolutely legit. If you did that sort of surface check, which I would warrant the person that's going to write a $25 or $50 check, that's kind of what they're going to do. They're going to see a picture of Jack Nimitz on the front page of their website and say, well, this looks legit to me. And they might look at a financial statement and they might look at the list of good works they've done and say, they look like the real deal.
So this guy, Jack Nimitz, who is the head of this charity, didn't exist. He was a made-up name. What percent of the people who were named on the website for U.S. Navy Veterans Association, what percent of those people, after all your reporting, turned out to be real, and what percent were fake in terms of, giving credibility to this group?
There were 81 directors and officers of the national and state chapters listed on the website, and John Martin undertook to try to verify the reality of all 81. And at the end of 6 months, we published our series. It was called Under the Radar in March of 2010. I think pretty much the opening part of that story said that, we undertook to find the 81 officers and directors of this group. We found only one, Commander Bobby Thompson. So whatever that percentage works out to, one out of 81 was what we found. And this was disconcerting, to tell you the truth. We did find that they had, the group had three attorneys. And these were real attorneys. They were Sam Wright, a distinguished, well-published labor lawyer and captain in the U.S. Navy reserves with a long history of publications and work for labor. And there was the former Attorney General of Ohio, Betty Montgomery, and her firm, the General Counsel for the Navy Veterans, Helen McMurray, the former Attorney General, a Deputy Attorney General in charge of consumer affairs in the state of Ohio. These were real people. These were, great, pedigreed, distinguished lawyers. And it threw me back when I discovered that, because I said to myself, what are these sorts of people doing with what I believe to be a con man? And that's, of course, part of the story we tell.
Is, all right.
How these lawyers and also the telemarketing companies, how they were, I would say, I'm going to be kind, I think. I would say they were drawn into the web of intrigue by the commander. and we'll say that, to the best of my knowledge, they didn't know exactly what was going on, and frankly, hadn't done enough vetting to know what was going on.
Well, I want to ask you about that. We're talking with Jeff Testerman, former reporter, investigative reporter for the St. Petersburg Times. And we're talking about the new book that he co-wrote called Call Me Commander, a former intelligence officer and the journalist who uncovered his scheme to fleece America. It's about a scam that has deep ties to Tampa and Ybor City that bilked as much as $100 million from unsuspecting Americans. And this is WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. So why did these high-powered attorneys that this Commander Bobby Thompson, who ran this scheme, why did these high-powered attorneys and the call centers that worked for this nonprofit, why did they not check out to make sure that the story was legitimate?
Well, let's begin with the call centers. The telemarketing companies said they did some vetting. What they did was they looked at the website, they looked at some regulatory papers, and that's what they looked at. They never met Jack Nimitz. They never met any director or officer of the association other than Commander Bobby Thompson. The lawyers, in the same way, were hired and paid pretty well, you know, $250 an hour in expenses, and did the same thing. You know, they looked at the website. They said, well, that's, you know, that's a legitimate website. They might have pulled the IRS returns. And, you know, all the IRS returns were filed. The numbers on them were phony. But if you asked for the tax returns from the IRS, they'd been filed. The commander had filed them, and they'd filled in all the blanks, and they were there. And again, the regulatory people had gotten their paperwork, and it was all sort of seemed kosher. But again, the lawyers, you know, there's a general counsel, Helen McMurray, up there in Ohio, former deputy attorney general, hired as general counsel, never was invited to sit in on a board meeting of the U.S. Navy Veterans. Never met Jack Nimitz or any of the other directors, never sat down and chatted or broke bread with the state officers, even in Ohio. And she sort of wondered at some point about this. And a backstory that was provided was that Commander Thompson said, well, he would discreetly say, well, I'm involved in black ops, or I'm connected with the CIA, and at some point, I believe all the lawyers at some point believed that maybe this explained the things they weren't seeing, that this maybe was a CIA front. McMurray opined once that she came to believe back during the War on Terror that maybe the Navy Veterans was really a front that was involved in raising money to hunt for Osama bin Laden.
Mm. So don't ask too many questions, she was saying.
Well, and you know, the paperwork's filed, the money's coming in, you're representing a charity that, by the way, can be shown to have done actual good works. And, you know, this is, again, part of the genius of this particular con, is that the commander did write checks for verifiable good causes, charitable causes. There was $30,000 for a wheelchair van, you know, for a disabled veteran who'd lost his legs in Afghanistan. There was, I should tell you, you know, there was $20,000 sent to your TV broadcast counterpart, WEDU. To sponsor the series carrier about the life aboard an aircraft carrier. By the way, the name of the carrier just happened to be the USS Nimitz, which I thought was hilarious. But he wrote those checks. I was pretty sure. I remember calling WEDU, and I was going to call them, and I was going to say, you didn't really get this check, did you? This is just made up. And it's phony, right? And they said, no, this is Commander Thompson is a good benefactor to the station, and we're thankful for his good works. So here and there, He sprinkled checks, and again, the money is coming in from the donors around the world. Mr. and Mrs. Jones are writing $10, $20, $30 checks. It's adding up to millions of dollars a year. Telemarketers are taking their cut, sending the rest to him. And he's occasionally writing a check to, he can put on his website that some reporter like me can verify, oh, well, yeah, he does actually send money to the TV station for sponsorship or whatever. But by and large, the lion's share of the money was unaccounted for.
Let me ask you this. The people who were called by call centers and asked to donate to the U.S. Navy Veterans Association, what was the pitch? What was the message that these call centers used? Because you're talking about raising at least $100 million from people around the country that wanted to give to a veterans organization. What kind of pitch did they use to the donors?
Well, it's interesting. I can verify this because, you know, one night while we were working on this story, it was a weekend, it was a Sunday night, and my wife got to pick up the phone, and it was the telemarketing company, and they randomly picked our home to call for a donation, and she said, I think you're going to want to take this call, and she handed the phone to me, and so I listened to the pitch, and what they say to you is that, you know, our veterans in the theater of war, and at that time, this is post 9/11. We're in Afghanistan. We're in Iraq. Of course, we're still there largely. You know, are paying a steep price for our freedom, and our veterans who come home deserve our support, and they are fighting and dying for our freedoms. And can't you do your part to help out? And in the post-11 sort of patriotic fervor that the nation was in, this pitch resonated with a lot of people. And I think it resonated maybe most with military veterans and their families. And we've talked to a few of those, and they said, you know, we know what it's like to be at war or to come home as a veteran and be looking for work or possibly even be homeless, and we know that an organization that cares about us is really important. And so they wrote checks like crazy, and it added up. There weren't lots of large checks. It really was in the $10 to $25 to $50 range, and we found in our research that if they gave once, then they went to a list and they were called again, and they might give two or three times, you know, over the course of a year or two.
Oh, so they kept hitting the same gullible people over and over again. The book is Call Me Commander. The co-author is with us, Jeff Testerman. And it's all about a scam that involved $100 million raised for a phony veterans charity called U.S. Navy Veterans Association. Jeff was a former staff writer at the St. Petersburg Times, and he uncovered this scam. So you said that a lot of the money is still unaccounted for. Some of the money was used for political contributions, and this is a nonprofit. Nonprofits are not supposed to donate to politicians' election campaigns, but they did. Who did they donate to, and how did they get away with it?
Well, this became one of the angles we stumbled upon as John Martin and I began to investigate. We began to, you remember the very first reason that I encountered Commander Thompson was a campaign contribution to Kevin White, $500 check was the reason I went to see him and talk to him. And he later amended a report on that, White did, and said it had been misentered, that the Navy veterans hadn't sent that check. It actually had been Thompson himself. And largely, the nonprofit refrained from making donations, and they were almost all of them in the name of the commander himself. Of course, we now know the commander had no source of income. The commander was not only not a commander, he was not who he said he was, and the money he claimed was his personal fortune was not his personal fortune at all. It was income derived from donations around the country. But to your question of who did the money go to, it went right up the line from the mayor of Tampa to, well, the city councilman, become County Commissioner Kevin White, to the governor of Florida, to and generally there was also a check that went to whoever the regulator was. You know, and Virginia, which is its own little chapter of this story, where they sent some lobbyists in to do some work, a $50,000 check went to Ken Cuccinelli, who was running for attorney general, and as attorney general, he was going to have some sway over what would be required of nonprofits as and what might be waived or not required of them. So he was an important person to send money to.
So
yeah, the cash went to senators. It went to senatorial campaign funds. It went to the President of the United States. And at the time, George Bush received a couple of contributions of the campaign for George Bush, George W. Bush. And, of course, we have one of the startling things we ran across was the photograph of Commander Bobby Thompson standing in a photo op with George W. Bush. This guy got past the Secret Service despite being not a commander. And not Bobby Thompson.
And he seemed to have a really good relationship with then-President Bush. And these donations bought him political cover and political access. And yet, I still don't understand why the U.S. Navy Veterans Association, that this guy, Bobby Thompson, really was the one-person brains behind, why the IRS didn't step in and say, wait a minute, you're making political contributions and you're a 501c3, you're a charity, you're not supposed to do that.
Well, once again, almost all the contributions were in Thompson's name, not in the charity's name. The key to this is that it was, and nobody could know this unless you looked at the bank account, as we were later able to do. The money would be funneled from the telemarketing company in Michigan down to the U.S. Navy Veterans account in Tampa, and Thompson would literally spend a day doing 7, 8, 9, 10 essentially money laundering operations, moving money from that Navy Veterans account to his personal account, to other accounts, and ultimately to accounts in names of men whose identities he had stolen. And so, to your question, almost all the political contributions came from an individual, not from the nonprofit. I would also add that the IRS simply is not equipped from a manpower standpoint to police nonprofits. They're happy if the tax returns come in and they can file them away, and it looks like they're following the rules.
Well, you point out in the book that the IRS was really bowled over by these powerful attorneys that the U.S. Navy Veterans Association had hired.
Well, and at some point, this was a critical point. In fact, the moment I arrived at Thompson's duplex in Ybor City, the commander's duplex, it was August 2009, and he was at that point, had been notified that the IRS had, and I'm pretty sure, randomly selected the Connecticut chapter of the U.S. Navy Veterans to for a tax audit. And in fact, the first thing he did was he emailed Helen McMurray, his general counsel, and he said, "It's over, Helen. We're done." And that was his initial reaction. The second reaction was to begin to compile and put together boxes of records. And truthfully, this evidence that was going to go for the Connecticut chapter, it was made up. It was boxes of receipts that he'd been using or collected, you know, from grocery buying and such for himself in Tampa. And, you know, he took these boxes of records to the attorneys who were going to defend him in this IRS audit and said, here's what the Connecticut chapter spent, you know, in the last couple of years. And they said, well, hold on, a lot of these from Tampa. And he said, well, he always had a story for everything. And this was, again, the, sort of the genius of the guy. He said, well, you know, there's a tax exemption in Florida to buy food, and so the Connecticut chapter has used its funds, sends down to the Florida chapter, and then the Florida chapter buys that food and gets the tax exemption, so it saves a little money, and that's why all this these receipts are from Florida, you know, that the Connecticut chapter is using as its records. And the attorney said, oh, okay, you know, like that. And they said, well, where are the, you know, you say you ship a lot of personal care packages to troops overseas. Well, where's the, well, how about the shipping receipts on that? And he says, well, you know, they got MacDill Air Force Base right here in Tampa, and we, what we're able to do is piggyback with them, and we'll send out 1,000 care packages to the troops, and they'll just put it on the transport plane, and it'll head to the Mideast, and so we don't have to pay anything at all. And the attorneys would say, oh, okay.
Was there any proof of that?
There's no proof of this whatsoever. At one point, we asked, as a reporting team, we said, well, can you show us some of the receipts for the distribution and the shipping of these care packages? Because this is where they said most of their money went. We're using millions of dollars a year to send care packages to the troops in Afghanistan and Iraq. And they came back and they said, well, we have an assortment of warehouses around the country. We have such a volume of receipts that it would be impossible for you to go through and for us to supervise that. And of course, we'd require you to pay up front, you know, thousands of dollars to do it, which was sort of shorthand for we ain't showing you anything. And they never did. And because they didn't exist, they didn't send care packages to anyone. This was the biggest lie of the on the expense thing that was going on.
Well, we're talking about a multi-million-dollar phony veterans charity that was uncovered by St. Petersburg Times reporter Jeff Testerman back when Jeff worked for the Times. He's written about it in a new book called Call Me Commander, a former intelligence officer and the journalist who uncovered his scheme to fleece America. So, Jeff, when you started, when you went to Ybor City and started to poke around and ask questions and then email this guy, Commander Bobby Thompson, who was the local representative of the charity, after a short time, he disappears. What happens to him?
Well, this is interesting because, you know, he disappeared before we knew about it. We were determined that we were going to, we got the okay to do this project, and we said, we're pretty sure something's going on here. We think we got a phantom charity. And our editors, and Richard Bachman was one in St. Petersburg that gave us the okay on this, and he trusted our instincts and frankly, our record of finding these things and putting them in the paper. And we were given 6 months to put this together. And again, we were trying to determine the reality of or the non-reality of the officers and of the works that they did and the legitimacy of this nonprofit. Thompson disappeared inside of about 2 months of our beginning to look at this. And we were corresponding with them at that time. We were sending letters. He had told us early on, we're not going to talk to you anymore. We're not doing any interviews. We frankly don't trust you. We think you're a tabloid newspaper that's out to, you know, put a hide up on, you know, on your wall there. And it's yellow journalism. It's fake news, so on and so forth. Which might sound like some other story that is literally going on as we now speak, but that's another angle. Thompson disappeared, and frankly, not even his attorneys knew where he was. What had happened was that Thompson had cleared out his duplex. He left no forwarding address. He had an assistant in Tampa that he left all his records with, such of those that remain, and told her to keep writing checks, you know, for regulatory renewals and licensing and that sort of thing. Meanwhile, he disappeared. And he ended up ultimately in New York City, which is a good place to hide. I mean, you know, if you want to hide in a big city, that's a good place to do it. And you can get out of New York City and get out of the country pretty quickly. One of the things he did was he began to use an identity of a veteran whose identity he had stolen, and he had gotten this individual's personal information. He had made up an entire set of identity cards, driver's license, visa, work card, you name it, with his own picture on it. And he was pretty cagey. I mean, he would go to, in this case, Indianapolis, and he would, every 5 years, he would show up to renew his driver's license as this person's name, and he would effect a disguise that looked like the person he was supposed to be impersonating. So he disappeared, and not even his attorneys knew where he was, but by all intents and purposes, he was still running the organization through his attorneys and through email and cell phone calls. But he was gone from Tampa, and when he disappeared, we sort of knew something was up. We knew we were on this story. But it was rather disconcerting for the attorneys to get an email from me and said, the commander has moved out of his place. Do you know where he is? And they said, he's moved out? So not even they knew where he was.
How was he arrested? How did the authorities finally find him?
Well, any one of 41 attorneys general might have prosecuted this. Ohio is the one that took this case on, and it was Rich Cordray was at the time the attorney general of Ohio, and he got interested in this case because there was a lot of money coming into Ohio. There was a lot of money being collected in Ohio. It's one of the bigger states for contributions coming in, and this veteran's charity. Virginia would be another with all its veterans and military bases and background. But Rich Cordray, frankly, he was piqued a little bit by the political money coming into Ohio. Now Governor DeWine had received a check when he was a senator. The two attorneys that were representing the group were right there in Columbus, Ohio. A lobbying group had been hired in Ohio. Essentially, the entire legislative congressional delegation had received money from the Navy veterans. And Cordray wondered if there was some sort of political angle, and he launched an investigation. And the first thing that happened was that he sent his people to track down the three officers that were listed for the Navy Veterans State Chapter in Ohio. And they went, and they found that, it's not a business address per se. It's a mail drop. And they went in and they subpoenaed the records for the mail drop. And Bobby Thompson was listed there. And they got the Social Security number for Bobby Thompson. And they discovered right then that the Bobby Thompson with that Social Security number was a man that lived out in Bellingham, Washington, whose identity had been stolen. Mm. And, of course, they sent somebody out to knock on his door as a Native American guy. And he said, do you know anything about your identity being used with the Navy veterans? And, of course, the guy said, I had no idea. But this was... this was who Bobby Thompson was. The commander was using a stolen identity of a man named Bobby Thompson. He would later use a number of identities, generally of Native American individuals who he had very, very cleverly stolen the identification numbers, Social Security, date of birth, et cetera, from in a remote area in the Navajo Nation down in New Mexico, cleverly outlined, and we exposed how he did that in the book. They chase these identities every time he makes a purchase with one of these identities. A record pops up, and so the Ohio investigative team, which includes some federal marshals, are tracking these records right across the country, and they literally chase him across the country up into the Boston-Providence area, over into the finally the Portland, Oregon area. Keep in mind, they don't know his name. They are chasing the identities that he's stolen. By virtue of every time he makes a purchase, you know, this identity pops up, and they chase that one, and then they chase the next one. They finally get to Portland, Oregon. They believe they found the guy, or generally where he is, because recent purchases have been popping up in about a six-block area in Portland, Oregon. And a task force of about seven officers determines they're going to sit on this six-block area. And literally the first night they're there, one of the marshals sees a guy that goes into a bar, and he follows him in, sits down at the bar, and he picks up his cell phone, and he sends a text back out to his task force and says, he's here. He's sitting at the bar right now. Commander Bobby Thompson, or whatever his name was there. And they... ultimately, they captured him. There's a pretty good story about the chase. They let him go for a little bit because they thought he would take them to money or to a Confederate, perhaps, that he was working with. They finally put him in cuffs. I still didn't know who he was. They booked him. We have a chapter called Mr. X because the commander booked himself when he signed the booking arrest sheet. He signed Mr. X, and they still didn't know who he was. What they did find was a key to a storage locker in Portland, and they went, got a subpoena for the storage locker. They went in, and they found two suitcases. One of the suitcases held 13 complete sets of stolen identification that he could or had already used, and the second suitcase contained very nearly $1 million in cash, which, and this is one of my favorite little details, was wrapped in the newspaper of the Tampa Tribune. So, and I'll leave that right there. So they had their man. They had some of the proceeds. They had some of the stolen identification. They had plenty to make, all, you know, the case they needed to make. It took them a few more months to figure out who he was. And the story of who he was unfolded as a federal marshal sat reviewing cold case wanted posters a few months later and ran across one and kind of did a double take and said, this looks like Mr. X. And they pulled the fingerprints for this wanted poster and checked them with the fingerprints they had for Mr. X sitting in a jail cell in Ohio and Cleveland, and there was a match. And the shocking news, it shocked me, frankly, that came back was that Commander Bobby Thompson turned out to be John Donald Cody, a Harvard-educated lawyer who had gone on the lam and who had spent a period as a captain in the U.S. Army Intelligence Corps and had connections with the CIA.
Mm. So he goes on trial. He's found guilty in Ohio, and he's in prison right now. But do we know, is all the money accounted for?
Well, we don't think all the money is accounted for. The $100 million figure has been thrown around, and we're the ones that compiled that. We ordered up all the IRS records and begin to count up the money he claimed to bring in. And it, like, those numbers on the IRS documents, of course, were phony, and and were meant to be window dressing to exaggerate the importance of his so-called charity. We do believe, through other records, that there is probably as much as $40 million was brought in. And we have not been able to account for this. My co-author, Daniel Freed, and I pored over bank records in great detail, and we see him traveling around under various identities. We see him staying at, four-star hotels and eating at nice restaurants. When he was in Tampa, again, I think part of the kind of the genius of this con was that he lived frugally. He lived in a crummy, dilapidated duplex. He didn't drive. He didn't even have a driver's license. He didn't live high on the hog. So he didn't give away the fact that he had a lot of money to spend. But we do think that some of this money went somewhere else. And is it offshore? Think about this. He put some of that money in a storage locker. Did he put some more money in a storage locker or two or three somewhere else? And he's been in prison now 9 years. Did the rent on those storage lockers expire? Mm-hmm. And did somebody come in and one of those auctions you see on TV on Storage Wars, did somebody buy a suitcase or two out of this unknown locker and open it up and say, oh, my God, look what I've just found? I don't know. I'm making this up as I go. But, no, we don't know where all the money went. We don't think it's all accounted for. But we know where he is and how he did it.
Well,
and we also now can account for his whereabouts and what he was doing when he disappeared for a 15-year period before he got to Tampa. And it's a period that no one has ever been able to figure out what he was doing, what he was up to. He likes to claim that he was always part of a CIA operation, that he was working for the Bush administration, that he was raising money, to fight the war and terror and to entice European allies to join the war and terror with America. And this he continues to write these claims out of prison. He thought a few weeks ago, he thought that he qualified for a pardon from President Trump for this. But, of course, he didn't have the connections to get to the president in this particular case. But there's no doubt. He is. I spent 33 years with the paper doing investigative reporting. I ran across a lot of intriguing characters. None were any more intriguing or fascinating than John Donald Cody. He was quite the adversary. And his story is one of intrigue and mystery. Don't know that we've got all the questions answered, but we've told this story more whole than has ever been done before, and we're pretty pleased. Daniel Freed, my co-author, and I are really, really happy with what we've been able to put together. We think we have a page turner. And we think that there are some lessons here about vetting a charity, about the value of local journalism, about what's important in local news and the mission of reporters to tell the public what's legitimate and what's not.
Jeff, I wish we had more time, but I'm out of time. And thank you so much for coming on and telling us about your new book, Call Me Commander.
It's a pleasure. It's been great to be with you.
That's Jeff Testerman, who back in 2009-2010 had been a veteran investigative reporter for the then St. Petersburg Times, and he covered the case of this $100 million scam operated out of Ybor City that ripped off people who were interested in donating to a veterans charity. The charity was called the U.S. Navy Veterans Association, And it was headed by essentially one person. It was a one-person scam, Commander Bobby Thompson. He called himself in Ybor City. Later, it turns out that he was a Harvard law grad, John Donald Cody. The book is called Call Me Commander, and you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. If you want to comment about anything you've heard here so far, you can call us up at 813-239-9663. Also, our email address is dj@wmnf.org. The impeachment trial gets underway beginning at 1 o'clock this afternoon, and you can bet that we will be talking about it all week here on WMNF. We'll play some highlights tomorrow at 11 o'clock and open up the phone lines. And let me read some of the emails that have come in. Timothy writes, regarding the insurrection, Timothy writes, no one seems to be asking about the tours given leaders of the insurrection on the previous day. Who okayed that? Who were the leaders of the break-in on January 6th talking to inside the Capitol to get that or those tours? Timothy, I'm sorry, I'm having a little bit hard time reading this, but he goes on to write, why did two police officers commit suicide? Please consider these questions, writes Timothy. There is going to be, according to news reports out this morning, there is going to be new information provided to members of the Senate about the insurrection at the Capitol. Apparently, during the trial, there will be some new information provided. So I guess we'll just have to stay tuned. David writes this, I remember the newspaper articles on Bobby Thompson. It's just a reminder to do your due diligence before you donate to charities. There are plenty of worthy charities that you can support, and there's an awful lot of scammers like Thompson, too. You know, it's interesting. There is a charity rating group called Charity Navigator. And apparently, according to this book, Call Me Commander, Charity Navigator gave the Thompson charity a very high rating. So they were able, the scammer was able to scam the charity rating group. And then Les writes, you can say what you want about Bobby Thompson, but that guy has to be one of the greatest, if not the greatest, con artists of all time. What an amazing story. I have to read the book, writes Les, who's listening in, I think, Brooksville. Les, thank you for that. 813-239-9663. We're going to hear the your hero, Mark Bureau, coming up in the next hour. And tomorrow in this program, we'll be talking about the first day of the impeachment trial. The impeachment of President Trump for the second time gets underway today at 1 o'clock in the U.S. Senate. And it will go on for many hours today, and they'll present evidence and lots of video. So I promise that tomorrow on this program, we will pay close attention to what was said today. In the meantime, stick around for your hero, Mark Bureau, right here on WMNF in Tampa. And if you want to comment about today's show, call us at 813-238-8001 and record your comment on extension 115. In just about a minute and a half or so, we'll get the latest news from NPR here on WMNF in Tampa.
My hand are golden. Help you cultivate horse sense and a cool head and a keen eye. Did you ever take and try to give an ironclad leave to yourself from a three-rail billiard shot? But just as I say it takes judgment, brains, and maturity to score in a bop-line game, I say that any boob can take and shove a ball in a pocket. And I call that sloth the first big step on the road to the depths of degradation. I say first, medicinal wine from a teaspoon, then beer from a bottle. And the next thing you know, your son is playing for money in a pinchback suit and listening to some big out-of-town Jasper hearing him tell about horse race gambling. Not a wholesome trotting race, no, but a race where they set down right on the horse. Like to see some stuck-up jockey boy setting on Dan Patch? Make your blood boil, well, I should say. Now, friends, let me tell you what I mean. You got one, two, three, four, five, six pockets in a table. Pockets that mark the difference between a gentleman and a bum, with a capital B, and that rhymes with P, and that stands for pool. And all week long, your River City youth will be frittering away. I say your young men will be frittering. Frittering away there noontime, supper time, chore time too. Get the ball in the pocket. Never mind getting dandelions pulled to the screen door patched to the beefsteak pounded. Never mind pumping any water till your parents are caught with a cistern empty on a Saturday night, and that's trouble. Yes, you got lots and lots of trouble. I'm thinking of the kids in the Knickerbocker, shirt tail young ones, peeking in the pool hall window after school. You got trouble, folks, right here in River City. Trouble with a capital T, and that rhymes with P, and that stands for pool. Now, I know all you folks are the right kind of parents. I'm going to be perfectly frank. Would you like to know what kind of conversation goes on while they're loafing around that hall? They were trying out Bevo, trying out Cubabs, trying out TaylorMades like cigarette fiends, and bragging all about how they're going to cover up a telltale breath with sense. And one fine night, they leave the pool hall, heading for the dance at the Armory, Liberty.